Hello, you're listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, a product of Lee Enterprises. My name is Chris Lay, and I am the podcast operations manager here at Lee. With Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles, we are presenting notable true crime stories, as reported by journalists from the dozens of various Lee Enterprises-owned publications from around America. For this collection of episodes, we're focusing on Omaha, Nebraska, where journalists from the Omaha World Herald newspaper will tell the tale of two sets of brutal double murders that took place 5 years apart and shocked the otherwise quiet neighborhoods where they occurred. Initially, police were confounded by the crimes, but eventually investigators found themselves on the trail of an unlikely suspect, whose arrest was followed by a bizarre and high-profile trial. Episode 5, which you're about to hear, was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting alongside fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and it was read for us by the World Herald's digital director, Z. Long. Now, it might go without saying, but given the subject matter here and every story that we're going to document going forward, there are some obvious content warnings to impart. Any stray curse words are bleeped out, but otherwise, everything you hear would be fit to print in a newspaper. That said, parents are still cautioned to give the episode a listen before sharing this with any youngsters. And now, here's Z. Long reading Episode 5, titled Into the Fight We Go.
The following podcast includes graphic descriptions of violence. It's based on the reporting of the Omaha World Herald and the book Pathological, written by World Herald reporters Henry Cordes and Todd Cooper, and available online through Wild Blue Press.
The team of Omaha police detectives tracking suspected serial killer Dr. Anthony Garcia had already mined Garcia's cell phone records to help build a case against him. Those records prove Garcia had been in the Omaha area on Mother's Day, just hours after the murder of Roger and Mary Brumback. But those records would soon yield much, much more. Detective Nick Herfert continued to work the records, next wanting to see exactly who Garcia had been talking to on his cell phone. Going down the call log, the detective looked up each phone number in a reverse phone directory. Herfert first learned that the unanswered telltale call that had shown Garcia was near Omaha the day of the Brumback murders had actually come from his parents in California, perhaps intended to be a Mother's Day conversation between mother and son. Herfert soon found another phone number in the log that he saw belonged to an outdoor outfitting company in Terre Haute called Gander Mountain. Herfert had never heard of Gander Mountain, but fellow detective Derek Moyes, an avid hunter and wilderness backpacker, was familiar with the Gander Mountain brand. He also knew Gander Mountain sold guns. The detectives now wondered whether Dr. Garcia could have bought a gun from Gander Mountain. And thanks to the Omaha Police Department's resident gun guru, they already knew exactly what make a gun they were looking for. Right after finishing the crime scene investigation at the Brumback home weeks earlier, Moyes had gone to meet Dan Brito of the Omaha Police Department Crime Lab. Moyes dropped on Brito's desk all the handgun parts and pieces they had found on the floor of the Brumbacks' home, the small broken-off U-shaped piece of the frame, the rod, the spring, and the ammunition clip. He also presented Brito with a shell casing found in the doorway and a bullet slug on the kitchen floor. "Can you tell me what kind of gun these came from?" Moyes asked. Moyes knew from experience that if you ever wanted to know anything about a gun and wanted to take that information to the bank, you go talk to Dan Brito. The Omaha crime lab technician possessed an encyclopedic knowledge of firearms, from their history, manufacture, function, and capabilities, right down to the damage they do when fired into human flesh and bone. As usual, Brito did not disappoint. He examined the parts, the rifling, and the slug, and the contact marks on the casing, and the very next day he got back to Moyes. "You're looking for an SD9, he said. Moyes was quite familiar with the Smith & Wesson SD9. It was a 9mm handgun with a distinctive two-tone finish, stainless steel slide, and a 16-17 round clip. Find someone with an SD9, and you find someone who could have shot and killed Roger Brumback. So weeks after finding gun seller Gander Mountain in the gun records, the detectives played a hunch. They obtained a search warrant to find out if Garcia had bought a gun from Gander Mountain. The records came back the next day, and the detectives soon saw they'd hit another bullseye. On March 8, 2013, 2 months before the Brumback killings, Anthony Garcia went to Gander Mountain, near his home in Indiana, and bought an SD9. Another piece of the puzzle came in soon after. Obtaining Garcia's credit card records, the detectives found he had actually used his card twice to make purchases in Omaha the day of the Brumback murders, buying a case of beer at a convenience store and stopping at an Omaha restaurant for some chicken wings. The restaurant was just blocks away from the Brumback home, and the time of the purchase fell right between the break-in at the Beatra home and the Brumback murders. That beer also came with a bonus. The convenience store had surveillance video of the transaction. Soon, the Omaha detectives were streaming video of Garcia himself, buying the Bud Light with his credit card. As Moyes watched the video, he knew this clip was almost bulletproof. Irrefutable proof Garcia was in Omaha the day the Brumbacks died. The Terre Haute resident would have a hard time explaining how he just happened to be in the city on the day the man who fired him from his medical residency was murdered. With that evidence now in hand, the detectives knew it was time. All these weeks they had been investigating Garcia, they had done so with the very real concern that at any time he could kill again. The time had now come to take Dr. Garcia off the streets. In the task force room at police headquarters, there was a buzz in the air as Team Garcia detectives assembled with command officers, the police chief, and one of the county's chief prosecutors. It was now July 12th, 6 weeks after Moyes, Hereford, and Davis had started on the trail of Dr. Anthony Garcia, and 3 weeks since they got the cell phone tower hit. It was time for prosecutors to decide whether there was enough evidence to seek a warrant in his arrest, and it was up to Detective Moyes, Hereford, and Davis to make that sale. Moyes, Hereford, and Davis flashed their PowerPoint up on a screen, walking all assembled through the evidence revealing Dr. Garcia's tale of failure, vengeance, and blood. His 2001 firing from Creighton University's pathology department. The signature knife wounds to the necks of all four victims. Garcia's silver SUV with pastel plate that matched the car seen outside Dr. Bill Hunter's home in 2008. The verification letters from Hunter and Brumback that cost him his medical licenses and seemed to trigger the double murders. The cell phone call near Omaha. Garcia's handgun matching the style of the gun used to kill Brumback. The credit card purchases and the convenience store video. For the prosecutor, it was an easy call. Let's go get him. 2 days later, the commercial jet carrying a team of 7 Omaha detectives touched down on the tarmac of the Indianapolis International Airport. The plan called for the detectives to pick up their rental cars, drive to Terre Haute, set up in a hotel, and coordinate with local law enforcement. And then, hopefully in the pre-dawn darkness early the next morning, they'd follow behind a SWAT team that would kick down Garcia's door. Believing Garcia to be potentially armed and dangerous, the hope was to catch him while he was asleep. But not long after the officers landed in Indianapolis, they were all thrown for a loop. One of the lieutenants directing the task force noticed it right away. "He's moving," he said. You see, for the past 2 weeks, the task force had been secretly keeping an electronic eye on Dr. Garcia. Hereford had gone to the court for a search warrant that allowed the task force to ping Garcia's cell phone each half hour, getting an email from the cell phone company letting them know the GPS coordinates of the phone. The latest pings showed Garcia had left his home in Terre Haute. He had crossed into Illinois and was headed south. By the time the task force gathered in Indiana, they could see Garcia was now 2 hours away in Salem, Illinois, a small town just off Interstate 57. He appeared to have stopped there, perhaps for the night. What was he doing? Was this some random business trip? Or had he been tipped off that the police were closing in? Or worse, was he headed somewhere to kill again? With the southern path Garcia was currently on, it didn't look like he was headed for Omaha. But I-57 through Illinois was precisely the route one would take to get from Terre Haute to Shreveport, Louisiana. From their probing of Garcia's background, they knew there were still people at Louisiana State University Medical School in Shreveport who had a direct hand in his firing. The concern he was now on another deadly vendetta was real. There were 2 FBI agents on the task force who had been en route to Terre Haute to meet up with the detectives. It was decided that agents Jonathan Robitaille and Kevin Hytrek should now head south, locate Garcia, and get their eyes on him. The agents hit Salem just before dusk. They pulled off Interstate 57, and soon they located Garcia's car, a black Mercedes SUV they knew was registered to him, and it was in the parking lot of a hotel. The agents checked into another motel next door, picking a room that would give them a clear view of Garcia's parked SUV. They also called for additional FBI backup. The plan was to continue to tail him in the morning to try to learn more about where he was headed. It was now nearly 1 a.m. The agents decided the best thing to do was to get some sleep and prepare for a potentially long day ahead. They set an alarm for 5 a.m., figuring Garcia wouldn't get up on the road before then. They figured wrong. One agent woke up just before 5 a.m. to see Garcia's SUV gone. The latest ping showed he was still in Salem, so he had not been gone for very long. The agents flew south on the interstate at speeds reaching 100 miles per hour, scanning the road for a black SUV. They soon got the latest cell phone ping coordinates. Garcia was now a half hour behind the agents. They had left town before he did. The agents flipped a U-turn, headed back north, and soon they spotted Garcia's SUV heading right toward them. They whipped around again, got in behind him, and blended into traffic. They drove on like that for an hour. Clearly, Garcia was not headed back home, and Garcia would soon be crossing the Missouri state line. Talking by phone with the Omaha Task Force leaders, it was decided it was time to stop him. The FBI agents alerted the Illinois State Police and asked them to make the stop. That's when Garcia again did the unexpected. Some 36 miles from the Missouri border, Garcia pulled off the interstate. Right at the same exit where the two troopers who had just been given the order to stop him were parked. It was an amazing coincidence. The troopers were shocked to see the black SUV they'd just been asked to stop suddenly driving right by them. And Garcia was clearly spooked at the sight of the troopers, immediately trying to head down the ramp to get back on the interstate. He only got halfway down the ramp before the troopers swooped in and ordered him to stop. Guns drawn, the troopers ordered Garcia out and told him to get on his knees on the pavement. As Garcia complied, the troopers called out again, asking if he was armed. Garcia admitted he had a gun. Though it was early in the morning, the troopers could smell alcohol on Garcia's breath. They cuffed him and booked him for DUI. But the doctor would soon learn he had bigger legal problems. Dr. Anthony Garcia was still settling into his cell in the county jail in Jonesboro, Illinois, when he was told he had visitors. He found himself sitting with Derek Moyes and Scott Warner, two Omaha detectives who had spent 5 years trying to find Tommy Hunter's killer. Moyes asked Garcia if he'd be willing to answer some questions, but as soon as Garcia learned the officers were from Omaha, he clammed up, saying he wanted to see a lawyer. After the detectives led Garcia back to his cell, they gave him some news, informing him they would be confiscating all his personal belongings. "I have a warrant from Douglas County, Nebraska, charging you with 4 counts of first-degree murder," Moyes told him. He had waited a long time to say those words. To Moyes, Garcia seemed during their meeting to be meek, not at all what he expected from a man capable of killing 4 people. Including an 11-year-old boy. But as Moyes, Warner, and other Omaha detectives continued to investigate Garcia over the next 2 days, they made discoveries both bizarre and chilling. The same day that Garcia was arrested in downstate Illinois, Detectives Herford and Davis served a search warrant on Dr. Garcia's home in Terre Haute. After arriving at Garcia's suburban cul-de-sac, they right away noticed the Ferrari parked out front. But as detectives learned with Dr. Garcia, it was all about projecting an image of success. A neighbor told them the seldom-driven Ferrari was always parked out in the driveway for everyone to see, even though Garcia's two-car garage sat completely void. The detectives also found a house almost devoid of furnishings. Garcia had slept on a blue air mattress, apparently unable to afford even a bed. There were beer cans scattered all around. On a table, they found 8 neat stacks of papers that included Garcia's Utah medical degree, his Illinois medical license, and the deed to the house. For homicide detectives who were used to investigating suicides, this was a familiar scene, the appearance of a man putting his affairs in order. Then in the kitchen sink, they found a pile of papers soaking in a strange nausea-inducing chemical bath that seemed intended to destroy the papers. Among the papers, the detectives found a number of documents that grabbed their interest. Some of the documents Herford and Davis were already well familiar with. Copies of the bad reviews Dr. Garcia had received from Dr. Beatra at Creighton. and the original letter from Bill Hunter and Roger Brumback firing him from his Creighton residency. Another paper showed Garcia was in dire financial straits. There was a copy of a recent letter he'd written to his homelender seeking to stave off foreclosure, the letter saying he had not worked in more than 5 months. The doctor said he had been unable to get another medical job due to his severe clinical depression, as well as his lack of board certification in a medical specialty. In the chemical bath, the detectives also found a number of handwritten notes expressing thoughts ranging from the incriminating to disturbing. Invade rich house. Torture. Murder. Jack. Rich children. Gun. Invade. Kill. Knife. Garage. Kidnap family. Torture. Kill. As Detective Ryan Davis looked the paper over, the words seemed the ramblings of a psychopath. Antisocial, homicidal, completely lacking any human empathy. Hundreds of miles away in southern Illinois, Moyes and Herfert made more alarming discoveries as they searched the Mercedes SUV Garcia had been driving when arrested. Among the eye-opening pieces of evidence they'd log, a .45 caliber handgun and a box of ammo, a brand new sledgehammer and crowbar, a box of rubber gloves, a road atlas containing handwritten directions to Shreveport, Louisiana, some 8 hours directly down the road from where Garcia was stopped, a stethoscope, and most chillingly of all, an LSU medicine lab coat. Moy's eyes widened as he spied the coat, with the school's distinctive logo on the chest. Why would Garcia pull that out of mothballs more than 5 years after he'd been fired by that school? Add that to the gun, maps, and burglary tools, it appeared to Moyes that Garcia truly was headed to Shreveport to seek more revenge against those he blamed for his career failures. Moyes and Warner also found evidence in the car that his trip was also part of a grander suicide mission. In a blue LSU shoulder bag, the detectives found 3 manila mailing envelopes that Garcia had addressed to his parents. They were stuffed with more important documents, including titles to his cars and information on his life insurance policy. A note with the papers dated the day before he took off on his southward trip offered only this explanation. Please hold these documents in case of an emergency. Your son, Anthony Garcia. One personal list of to-dos in the satchel included destroy bad info on myself, a seeming reference to what Davis and Hertford found soaking in the chemical sink. 2 other handwritten notes referred to Canada and New Orleans and could be interpreted as a possible suicide or escape plan. Rent boat. Have fishing gear. Look like a fisherman. In right hand, gun hidden. In left hand, phone, passport, driver's license. Poison hidden. Knife, knives hidden. Cash, Mercedes keys, medications. The road atlas with directions to Shreveport also included directions from Shreveport to New Orleans, along with information on New Orleans businesses that rented deep-sea fishing boats. Also significant to Moyes and Warner was what they didn't find in the car. Luggage. Not even a change of underwear. Clearly, Garcia wasn't on vacation. As Moyes and Warner processed all the evidence taken from Garcia's car, they attempted to piece it all together. Moyes' best theory was that as Dr. Garcia's personal life spun out of control due to his failed medical career, Garcia was on his way to Shreveport to kill LSU officials who had fired him 5 years earlier. The presence of both the lab coat and the burglary tools suggests he could have been targeting them in their homes or even in the halls of the school itself. Then he planned to drive to New Orleans, rent a boat, and shoot himself in a way that his body would fall overboard and be lost at sea. That would allow his parents to collect on the life insurance policy he was mailing them. Moyes' theory was further buttressed by a note Herfert and Davis found in Garcia's home that also suggested he was ready for some kind of deadly final stand. Into the fight we go, it read. We live, we die, we live, we die. Next time, Dr. Anthony Garcia's murder trial features a surprise star witness.
Thanks for listening to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles. This series was written by Omaha World Herald staff writer Henry Cordes, based on his reporting with fellow World Herald journalist Todd Cooper, and read by the World Herald's digital director Z. Long. You can get loads of other information at omaha.com, and links to relevant articles and content can be found in the show notes. Make sure that you're subscribed to Late Edition Crime Beat Chronicles wherever you listen to your podcasts, so you'll be the first to hear our next episode, coming out in 1 week. The show was produced and edited by me, Chris Lay, with tremendous thanks to Henry Cordes, Todd Cooper, Z Long, and the rest of the team at the Omaha World Herald for the work they put in covering, researching, and recording the story. For Lee Enterprises, I'm Chris Lay.